I think we're live.
Oh, yeah?
Hey, what's up, guys? Oh, I didn't see you there. Sorry, we've just been chilling out, just watching Jean-Claude Van Damme clips and clips of Steven Seagal running on YouTube.
Busy day.
Busy day. Fantastic. It's just business as usual here at Flow Grappling HQ, right?
Just dreaming about a world that could have been.
Man, I gotta say, I think that, you know, maybe the contributions that those have given to the martial arts community and, as you say, the world in general, are just so underrated, you know? Just think about the good that Steven Seagal has done in this world.
Debatable, but Van Damme, however.
Let's talk about Van Damme. Dolph Lundgren, yeah, Jean-Claude Van Damme, all about it. Those guys are great.
This was the golden era of action movies back in those days, right? What's your favorite, Chase? I know that you're a huge Jean-Claude Van Damme fan.
I mean, the answer, the correct answer to this, by the way, is Bloodsport.
Really?
It's the movie that kicks it off for everyone. And if you enjoy that kind of film, you then go down the rabbit hole of Seagal comes into play, Bruce Willis, all the 80s action heroes.
See, now you say Bloodsport. I can't agree. I can't agree.
I need you to leave.
No, because how can you possibly say that Bloodsport is better than Kickboxer? I mean, Kickboxer is like the ultimate Jean-Claude Van Damme movie. Come on.
You've just started a blood feud. I do love Kickboxer. He goes to Thailand and all that stuff.
Amazing. But
dances in a bar.
That
does the splits. That punches guy in the balls.
Jean-Claude Van Damme performance.
100%. 100%. I like where this is going today. Today is a great podcast.
We can talk about Legionnaire. We were watching Hard Target.
I used to love Legionnaire. That was actually one of my favorites. I don't think it got the credit it deserved as a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie. It gets overlooked.
Yeah. I think actually the thing that really people don't understand is that Van Damme pioneered the twins thing where he started two different movies with like doubles and partnering
that's right.
up. Incredible. I think Double Impact was one of those.
Yeah.
And what is the other one?
There was another one.
What's the one with Dennis Rodman and Bruce Willis? Is that like
maybe that's Double Impact? Double Dragon? I'm mixing
Double Dragon. There's only so many double puns.
But Van Damme did it all.
Yeah.
And then Seagal did a movie of DMX.
We have our first comment coming in, and I'm afraid to say Chase agrees with me because Ronnie Walker says that yes, Kickboxer was the best.
Ronnie Walker, and you can walk up into the sunset.
But he's right. Tong Po is the best martial arts villain of all time. You know that famous scene where he's like kicking the concrete pillar
before the fight.
That was very scary. But yeah, that's definitely between those two though, Kickboxer and Bloodsport. Because Bloodsport, man, is just an incredible movie.
There he is.
It's incredible. Guy. Come on, remember when they? Yes, exactly.
Pocket Sand made his debut in Bloodsport.
Right, and they're fighting. He's got to find the tooth. He's got to find the tooth on the mat.
That's right.
That, and then that's like where I learned that there was like different fighting styles. There's like a monkey fighting style, and there's like just like a being big and tough.
That's pretty racist, I think, actually, back then.
Big and tough, strong man fighting style, kung fu fighting.
I always liked how they always had like the token kind of like American bare knuckle biker dude or something. He'd just be the slugger.
Like, what was he good at? He was just good at like
violence.
Yeah. Like, what was his martial art? He was just like, I drink beer.
Kind of like bite their ear or something, like Tank Abbott style. I don't know. But speaking of Tank Abbott, man, you know, I came across something the other day. He's like, apparently he's been in and out of hospital recently. He had like a straight up liver transplant and stuff. Yeah.
OG.
He does not
Snake
look
pit fight systems.
Yeah, he does not look like the Tank Abbott of old. Because when That's I saw this old photo.
Got skinny.
I saw. He's like super skinny and he's all gray and stuff.
He wrote a book, actually.
Did he?
Yeah. He wrote a book.
No way.
Maybe a couple years ago.
Wow. I bet that's actually fascinating because I bet that guy has got some incredible stories.
Yeah, it's all about, you know, his fighting in the, you know, bar rooms
bar
and stuff
brawls,
like that.
Right.
Yeah.
That's where that honed their skills.
He was the original Huntington Beach bad boy, right? Like Tito straight up stole his nickname.
Really?
Yeah.
He's from Huntington Beach, huh?
Yeah, because Tank was like, dude, this is crazy. Like, but Tito was originally brought in to be a training partner for Tank, like in the late 90s. And then, like, obviously, Tito kind of had a couple of matches in UFC, a couple of fights, and he started winning, and he became like the big star of like the early 2000s, right? Mm. But, like, you know, Tank was never an athlete, but Tito was. So it's a little bit of MMA history right there. But, we're talking a lot about martial arts movies and stuff today, right?
Martial arts movies. We're some of the, like, just straight-up martial arts movies. I was a big fan of Power Rangers back in the day, but...
I watched a lot of Power Rangers.
Yeah,
personally, I was a huge fan of, like, the Jackie Chan and Jet Li kung fu movies as well.
Yeah,
I got really into, like, the Hong Kong martial arts movies.
The Black Mask, I remember watching that one.
You guys
one.
Ever see the documentary Budo, The Art of Killing? It is so sick. It's, like, made in the late 70s, I want to say, and It kind of chronicles all of Japan's major martial arts, like karate, judo, sumo. Aikido. Sumo's right. in there.
Sumo's like the best one.
Yeah, the torture stretching exercises. Yeah, yeah.
There's like one like 300-pound dude, right? He's like trying to do a split, and they're just like pushing him to do a split.
I love
like,
the karate guy punching a train. He just is like yeah, just punching a train over and over again. By the way,
well, you know, you never know when a train might come up on your face, and you have to take that sucker out. You know, so.
I will say the way to bring it back a little bit to the beginning of this, the way to judge a good Van Damme movie is if it has leg torture in it. So, like, in Bloodsport, you know, his sensei rips his legs apart on the tree.
And the level of leg torture signifies the quality of the movie.
Exactly. Kickboxer, he's got to kick that tree until he snaps his shin or something crazy. There's a couple of Van Damme leg torture scenes throughout his history. So
that's how you know.
That's how you know you got a good one on your hands, is if he's being forced to do the splits.
Van Damme torture in general. That's how you know it's good.
Watching some Van Damme movies is torture. But what was the first like martial arts exposure you guys remember?
Because
like, we're all into jiu-jitsu now, but there was something else before that, right? So
I did. I think it was called Kenpo Karate when I was a kid.
But how'd you get into that? Like, did you get signed up by your parents?
I want to say my dad watched Seagal movies.
He was like, Chase, you're doing this.
He's like, we got to make you to a
Thank
fighter.
You, Mr. Smith.
Yeah, I don't quite know, but I got into it early, like 6, 7 years old, I want to say.
But I do feel like definitely, like, we would not be sitting at this table without Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Hell
like,
no.
He's, like, literally the reason why I, like... I'm sure, like, literally everybody.
I was feeling a bit down last night, so I watched Bloodsport last night. That's literally why I'm here today. So Van Damme got me in the office today.
The Bloodsport has the weirdest, like, structure of a movie. Mm. Like, because, like, there's so much flashback.
There's like, a 7-minute flashback.
Yeah, yeah. There's, like, a good chunk of the movie that's just, like, a flashback. And you're like, oh, yeah, yeah. Now back to the competition. But
bringing it back away from Bloodsport, what about you, Reeve? What was your first martial arts exposure?
I had a friend in like elementary school who did karate, and I think I went and did karate a couple times with him. I don't think I ever really signed up, but I do remember like getting the like Green Ranger like martial arts like VHS tape or something.
Whoa, he had his own
like an instructional.
Yeah, instructional. His own DVD. His own
Was it like aimed at kids?
Probably. I mean, I bought it. So, all right.
How many adults were watching Power Rangers? Like, how do I learn that shit?
Was he wearing the actual Green Ranger outfit? Or?
No. He was wearing stuff more that you would see in a
tactical.
in Bloodsport. Probably. He's wearing like silk pants and you know some sort of belt.
Cut-off
probably.
Shirts.
Yeah.
And he turned out to be the most legit of all Power Rangers. He actually fought MMA fights, right?
Yeah. So
what's his name? Jason. Something?
I learned a lot of good stuff from him. a lot of valuable techniques that I still use
today.
You
used to today,
yeah. Oh, my God.
Oh, my word. That's amazing.
What is your martial arts origin story?
Way back.
Same, dude. Karate. Like, I had, you know, friends in, like you say, elementary school who were, like, doing karate. And I got taken along to a lesson. I bugged my mother because I was, like, you know, a huge fan of anything like Power Rangers and Ninja Turtles and stuff, and I was like, I want to do
Ninja
this.
Ninja Turtles was a good one,
yep.
Right? Yeah. And she let me go to one class, but then she wouldn't let me sign up. My mother wouldn't let me do it. I guess she had thoughts I'd become a violent hooligan. So,
I'm glad you went out of your way to prove it right.
Yeah, I know. Right? But yeah, I had to wait a very long time before I actually got to really invest in the martial arts. So that's why the Jackie Chan and the Jet Li movies are like living vicariously. I didn't realize that those guys were all on wires and stuff, you know, flying across.
But definitely also UFC brought me into martial arts too.
Absolutely.
That was definitely.
But you know,
a big
I remember
exposure.
Watching UFC like way back in the day and just thinking it sucked. I was like,
really?
Yeah, because this is the complete opposite of most people watch it, and they're like, it changed my life. I realized that there was more to fighting than just spinning kicks, and you know, it was like all about the groundwork. I watched it and I was like, this sucks. Where are the spinning kicks? It's like, what the hell are they doing? Just like twisting on somebody's foot. That's bullshit. And so I completely discounted it for years. And then I was like, I suppose it does work, right?
Man, I went down like the weirdest rabbit hole in 2006 and 2007 when YouTube came out. And like I came across like Pride Fights and K1 and UFC stuff. I had no idea what any of it really was because I didn't really know. I just remember in the news occasionally, like, MMA would come up as, like, human cockfighting, and that's all I knew about it.
Yep.
And then I agreed when I watched Pride. I was like, holy shit, this is insane. Like,
true.
What is this stuff?
You watch some early UFC, and you're you're like, oh, okay, that's kind of crazy. And then, like, yeah, then you pull up, like, a Mirko Krokop highlight or a Vanderlei Silva highlight on YouTube that everybody was watching, and you're like, those dudes are the scariest dudes I've ever seen in my entire life.
They made, like, UFC look tame. Yeah. You know, you had, like, Matt Hughes, like, laying praying on people, and then you'd flick over to Pride, and like you say, there'd be, like, head kick knockouts.
Soccer kicks.
Flying stomps and stuff. And it was like, ah, my God, how is this even legal? God bless Pride, man.
Pride somehow I watched this and was like, I should try that.
Yeah, right.
After like a couple of 5 years of watching, I'm like, I want to do something close to that. Not all of that.
Yeah.
Not all of
that. But
yeah.
Something like that.
Man, the good old days. I don't even watch MMA anymore.
No. Nah. You should have seen this Jorge Masvidal Ben Askren fight.
Well, that I did happened see that. Over the weekend. Yeah. Basically, if an MMA fight can fit into the length of if an MMA fight can fit into the length of an Instagram video, I will watch it. But I never watch MMA anymore.
I tune in for the big fights occasionally, but I can't.
There's a lot. Yeah. There's a lot of MMA.
There is. Yeah, it's hard. I mean, we have enough of a hard time keeping up with our own sport, you know, jiu-jitsu. So to keep tabs on all the promotions of MMA is tough. But.
I know, MMA is kind of, I mean, it's cool and all. I can appreciate, you know, spectacular acts of violence. You know, I can appreciate the artistry and, like, you know, setting up certain techniques. I don't really get the same buzz as watching jiu-jitsu guys in MMA, though, anymore. I don't know. Is it just me? Or is, like, I think we talked about this in the past, but I don't see any guys really, like, doing amazing jiu-jitsu MMA anymore. And that's kind of one thing,
man,
that I really...
You missed Lovato's last fight. Lovato's last fight was so sick.
Have we talked about that? Like, how...
I think we mentioned it in passing.
How
that he
sick
won.
It is that Lovato is a world champion in MMA, a Bellator champion.
That is incredible.
And he did it with jiu-jitsu, man.
So
like,
sick.
It was the takedown entries he was doing, like, he sort of pulled... half guard almost. He would go in for like a single, like a body lock, but then drop down to his knees and start wrapping up like a Lucas Leitch style half guard sweep. And it worked. He did like 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, get that underhook and come up with it.
And he was really torquing that leg when he had that half guard going. It was straight up just jiu-jitsu wrestling and working at the highest level.
And then the fifth round, right? His first ever fifth round, it was all jiu-jitsu.
I was worried there in the fourth. He was starting to fade. Look, he was getting a little tired. And Musasi was raining down some like big blows through his guard, through Lovato's guard. But then he just dug deep. I don't know where he went in that minute rest period. But
so sick that it happened. Sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
So sick that it happened against Gegard Mousasi, too, right?
Because he's
like a legend.
How many fights did he have? Like 50 fights or something?
Yeah, probably close to that,
for
sure.
Yeah, that's insane. In MMA, that's crazy.
And he's had a bunch of kickboxing fights, too.
Yeah.
So, like, it's awesome that he did it against, you know, just one of the most well-respected guys in the sport, Gegard Mousasi. He's been around forever, so that was awesome.
You know what I really respect, actually, is that Lovato implemented a really solid strategy for getting his jiu-jitsu to work, because this is something, a criticism a lot of jiu-jitsu guys, especially the crossover jiu-jitsu guys have, is that they just walk into the cage and it's almost like they expect their jiu-jitsu to work. But it's not that simple, is it? Because you need to have really strong strategies for getting to the positions that you want to work from. And especially like back in the day, but even still, unfortunately, you see some guys just almost like they expect to just go close guard and do jiu-jitsu. And it's like, it's not that easy, you know? It completely changes the game. You can't just drill some close guard from bottom or whatever. So it's like, That strategy of what you were saying there, Jason, about how Lovato was getting into that like half guard attacking position and then using it to open up so much stuff, it's like that's the jiu-jitsu that I get excited about in MMA
nowadays.
Yeah, it's
really cool, man.
You know?
I was standing up cheering when I saw that happen. Like, oh my God, he's doing it! He's doing it! It's working. So
yeah.
Dylan did really well with his jiu-jitsu as well, but not quite the same caliber of opponents as Lovato.
So yeah. Speaking of Dylan, we saw Dylan last week, right? We were there in Orlando for Kasai Super Series, and he was there to corner Munchie, who had an amazing, I think, submission of the night, right, against Enrico Coco.
And who's also, you know, working on making his transition to MMA and doing it right.
That's right. He's currently working through some kickboxing, right? But it was, I mean, how long ago was Dylan's fight? It's like a month ago, something like that?
Yeah,
roughly. So, you know, he's 2-0 now, and I said to Dylan when I saw him, I was like, man, you know, the first fight, I don't feel that people really got to see anything, because he tapped the guy out so quick. And Dylan was like, yeah, he's like, I wanted to really show people that I can fight, that it wasn't just like a lucky submission in that first match, you know? It's like, and the one thing I really enjoyed watching in Dylan's last MMA fight was he was super aggressive, and he was using ground and pound as a strategy to open up the submissions and stuff. I thought it was a good fight. It was a good showcase of his skills, right?
I know Damian Maia had another win pretty recently, I want to say, maybe 2-3 weeks ago. And then we have another jiu-jitsu athlete fighting again this weekend.
Do we?
AJ Agazarm's on the next Bellator. I didn't even know that you mentioned it this week.
No, it's true. He is fighting this weekend. I think that's actually really cool because AJ has... he was one of the most visible personalities and athletes, competitors in the sport for a few years there, right? He was one of the most prolific grapplers on the scene.
Very active, and, too.
You know, there's a gigantic AJ-shaped hole in sport right now. But he's gone over to MMA. So, you know, this is the chance, though, because he's going to have to prove himself this weekend, right?
Yeah, he definitely had a lackluster performance his first time out. Wasn't able to finish when he had some pretty strong positions. So I think he's definitely hoping to turn that around this weekend.
Yep. Yeah, you know, I think it's a good point that it's like it is hard to win in the cage, and got to give it up for Dylan for going out there and being 2-0 because it's not an easy thing for sure to, especially a guy like Dylan, man. He's got such a big target on his back.
Hell yeah!
Everybody wants to see him lose. So it you must be tough.
People must be lining up for the chance to fight Dylan. They want to be that first guy to take him out, right?
Yeah, and it's an attractive proposition too. He's not that proven yet. He's only 2-0. He doesn't have an amateur record. Yeah, so if you're trying to make a name, he's a pretty good target. So definitely excited to see what happens next for him as well.
Speaking of Dylan, did you guys roll with Dylan? Did right?
We rolled. I did. All of us rolled with him at rolled Pans him a couple in times. 2016.
Yeah, we rolled with him at the Ruka Gym in California, right?
Yeah, that's the only time I've trained with him.
Yeah, I trained with him. Yeah, we all trained with him at the Ruka Gym there, in the gi, right, like day before Pans.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And then I trained with him one time at Unity Nogi.
Oh yeah,
mm-hmm.
Cool. Because I think that's a really good segue into kind of the topic of today's episode, right? It's right there in the title: the best black belt you've ever rolled with. Question mark. Not statement. The best black belt you've ever rolled with.
So far.
Question mark.
Yes.
Best black belt you've ever rolled with.
Who is the best black belt you've ever rolled with,
let's,
Chase?
Let's move on.
No, in all seriousness, I was actually thinking about this last night. Damn, I'm not sure. Because there were a couple of really, really good ones. And I was trying to judge, like, okay, who's got the most world titles and who's there? So okay, who is the best black belt you roll with? I think that maybe we could start off with a couple of criteria because we've all had the pleasure and the good fortune.
All been very lucky.
Rolling with some very, very, very good ones, right? But let's start off, first of all, who's the most credentialed, do you think? Who's the guy with the highest number of accolades and titles and so on?
It'll actually be the gal in this case, Bia Mesquita, the female lady goat, and I did this little episode of Fix My Game where if you haven't seen those on the site, it's awesome. I roll with these athletes and then they point out some things that are wrong with my game, and I also focus on some things they do really well. So for her, we worked on a lot of close guard and fundamentals and things like that. But yeah, I mean, she is the greatest of all time. I can't even remember how many world titles she has. It's insane. It's like seven, something like that.
Mm-hmm. And so what was
you counting World Pro and ADCC?
Yeah, exactly. She's run more Nogi World. So yeah, she's definitely the most credentialed.
And so what was the like experience like, the actual role?
Man, there's definitely just a gap. Like you roll with a black belt at the gym, at our own gym, home gyms, and then you roll with someone that's world class, and it's incredible. You know, and there's no strength involved with her. She just takes advantage of like whatever I'm doing. It was just super fun and eye-opening, too, because what she was doing compared to like someone like Edwin, who's kind of flashy, you know, he's getting like crazy subs from somewhere. Renato Canuto, I've rolled with him, too, and it's just like flying arm bars from anywhere. She was just killing me with like the basic stuff.
Really?
You know, it was just limiting my movement and like taking my back from close guard and, you know, finishing me from side control with some really like what most people call basic things. And I thought I knew how to avoid them, you know, but I couldn't stop it. It was awesome. So it was really cool. And I definitely invite anyone who hasn't seen that episode of Fix My Game to check that out, because I think it's applicable to anyone, white belts and up. So some good stuff there.
That is really cool. Yeah. And I got to say that Fix My Game episode's really cool because I like Bia's jiu-jitsu because it stands out, right? In the modern era, Bia's jiu-jitsu is like the opposite of the majority of jiu-jitsu that you see. And if you really are one of those guys who likes good old-fashioned, traditional, functional jiu-jitsu that just works really, really well, man, that's the game for you, right? Bia is so good at that.
There's no real trends in her game. She just does what she does best against everyone.
Yeah. For years.
Yeah.
For a long time.
How about you, Reed? The most credentialed. Not the best, but maybe, you know, in terms of like this, but the actual person with the most number of titles and awards and so on.
Yeah, it's tough. Like I said, we've definitely been super lucky to get to go all over the world and roll with some of the best guys in the world. But I would say it was probably either Andre Galvao or Marcelo Garcia. Probably one of those two guys. But yeah. I'll talk about the Marcelo Garcia one just real quick, because that one was a great day. And I think Marcelo gave me a lot of good advice that day, too.
Oh, yeah?
He
imparted some wisdom.
He did. You're lucky enough to get to roll with these guys. And so, yeah, you definitely got to take as much as you can from it, because there is so much wisdom there. And it can be definitely an intimidating thing, right?
Oh, it's still scary.
Yeah, it's very intimidating when you, especially, you know, it was the first time I'd ever rolled with Marcelo, first time you ever rolled with Bia, right? So it's like a new thing, and obviously they have so much weight behind them. They have so many titles and things behind them.
You
so
kind of have to remind yourself that, damn it, they're just human, you know? Like, they have two arms and two legs, just like everybody else.
But then you roll with them, and you realize they're not human.
No, I'm wrong. I'm actually wrong.
But you do, like, I know what you mean, though. You almost second-guess yourself, because it's like, if I grab this arm here, it's like, what the hell are they going to do to me? They're just going to do all this crazy stuff because they know all these things. And it's like, you got to be careful not to beat yourself up before you
even
start.
What did Marcelo tell you? He said he imparted some wisdom.
Well, I had a great time with him, and they were doing 10-minute rounds that day. And so
Was it gi, no gi?
It was no gi. Cool. No gi, you know. And I like both, but...
That's a lie.
It would be cool to roll with him in the gi. I rolled 10 minutes with Marcelo, and then we stopped, and then he we slapped hands, and he was like, "You want to go again?" And so I was like, "Yeah, absolutely." You know,
dude,
so
you rolled 20 minutes with Marcelo in one day.
Two 10-minute rounds back to back.
Wow!
And it was incredible. You know, obviously, you know, like you said, like the technique that Marcelo possesses is far beyond my understanding of sport of jiu-jitsu. I'm working on it. It just feels like he's, you know, five steps ahead and everything. But I don't know. I'm trying to think exactly what he said to me. I can't remember exactly. But I remember some of the gist of it. It was about dealing with like the intimidation and stuff like that, and how, you know, going into a new gym is it can be tough. But I think it's like such a valuable thing to do is to go into a gym that you don't go to every day, and to seek out the tougher roles, or to seek out people that you haven't rolled with, because it can be scary and it can be very humbling. You can go into a gym, especially like Marcelo Garcia's, and get your butt whooped.
Absolutely.
Guaranteed. Time after time, you know?
I mean, it's almost guaranteed to happen if you roll with like the killers that they have in that room.
Exactly. So. Mateus even came up to me afterwards, and he was like, "Man," he was like, I was going to ask you for a roll, but you rolled twice with Marcelo, so I didn't want to be that guy."
You dodged a bullet there.
Yeah. But
that's cool, man. I wonder if it's still true, because Marcelo, he used to have that thing, didn't he? He used to.
I see Seth calling me out on there. Here. Seth Dent deals beat my ass in Hawaii. Is that what happened? All right. Yeah, he Kimura'd me a couple times for sure. Seth's legit, but
did he get you with the twister?
He didn't give him a twister, but not, maybe he could. But the twister is like a wrestling move, so I'm hip to that one.
You know that stuff, yeah.
But
Marcelo, he used to have that thing, didn't he? He used to roll with every single visitor that came to his gym.
I didn't know it was everyone. I knew he did it with a lot.
I think that's not even possible anymore because he receives so many nowadays. At one point it kind of was, and he certainly made the point of rolling with me like years ago when I visited his gym for the first time. But yeah, incredible, man. That's so lucky. Damn, 20 minutes from Marcelo.
No, absolutely.
So cool.
It was a great day. And those experiences, I feel like, make your jiu-jitsu grow so much, because just to feel, everybody's felt somebody really good.
Well, speaking of feeling people who are really, really good, I guess, like, you know, it's a toss-up between the best and the most credentialed, because... the most credentialed, like Kyo, I think it is for me, you know, because
Kyo as well.
I've also rolled with Kyo and Lucas Leppery. I feel like those guys are among the greatest as well.
But I mean, Kyo is like, what he's like, he's world champion and a 11-time world champion, I think it is. So, you know, he's pretty good. But the other person who I roll with who has an absolute boatload of credentials as well is actually Michele Nicolini. And Michele is, that was really interesting because, you know, so I'm about 180, 185, you know, and those guys are way, way smaller than me, of course. You know, they're probably both like walking around about 130. So, you know, I go into a role like that and I treat it very much as a learning experience, because I'm not gonna get anything by trying to go hard on anybody like that. And, you know, it's a chance to actually feel really, really solid functional technique as well, right? But I'll be honest, like, rolling with Michelle was really awesome because I got to feel this amazing half guard passing that she does. BJJ Scout had, you know, had an amazing study of her, like, tripod style passing from half guard, which is really, really cool.
I remember the shin trap stuff too she would do
from bottom. She didn't really do too much with me, but the passing stuff, I got to feel like how effective it was. It was really good. But man, I think you guys probably had a similar experience, but rolling with Kaio, he just messed me up.
He was telling Reed to go harder. It was hilarious. Yeah.
He kind of did the same thing to me as well. It's like he's rolling like about halfway through. He kind of stopped and he looks at me and he goes like, he's like, you can go a little bit harder if you like. You know, you don't have to roll so slow. And
he didn't even say that to me. He said, you need to go harder.
Oh, you need to. Yeah, oh, like, there you go. Yeah. But I mean, like, rolling with Kaio was really cool because, like, I just honestly, I didn't feel like I initiated or could do anything. I just, you know how you said, like, Marcelo was like 5 steps ahead? Like, that's totally how I felt with Kaio as well. I literally never felt in a position where I even had one grip that I could do something. Everything was reacting to him, whether it was top or bottom. And I got to feel the famous footlock as well.
Right? Oh, yeah. Footlock. Got caught with that a few times.
He put it on really nicely as well, because he kind of caught it and he looked at me and he's like, here it is coming. It's coming. There it is.
It's tight. It's tight. Yeah.
Who smashed you guys the worst out of the pros? They're all super nice, so it's a little bit more rare when they put it on you.
You know, they don't usually beat us up too bad, do they? I think if they did, they worried that they might not get too much coverage.
Like, I gotta get kind of gentle.
Yeah, so maybe they're a little bit too nice to us.
I would say, even though he was extremely nice by anyone's standards, Wagner was pretty tough to roll with. And he
gave us a taste. Yeah, he gave us a taste.
On the scale of Wagner, though, it was like a 3 out of 10. He takes it to a whole other place.
Yeah.
But I could see how just like his game is just like smothering and uncomfortable and miserable. Oh, God, and it was so impressive.
There was a moment like, you know? I always like really, really give a hard time to people who tap from pressure to positions, you know? I'm like, that is such a pussy thing to do, you know? And
don't
like,
sugarcoat it, Hal.
No, I'm straight up saying, like, you know, you tap to pressure, you're a bitch. It's like, come on. This is jiu-jitsu. There's no tapping to pressure, right? You just suck it up. Literally, my hand was like this. It was floating. When Wagner, he got the rear body lock, and he, like, you know, put me face down, belly down, and just, like, I didn't even know what he did, but the hips just kind of went down, and I just went, and my hand was, like, fucking float. I think maybe he saw it and then he kind of like backed off, because like I said, you know, he just gave us, he was like rolling with me and Chase like 10% at most, and then he dialed it up to about 40 just to let us feel it, and then he dialed it back down again, and it was like,
I never made the 40.
Oh my god.
Man, I was gonna say that it's usually the purple or brown.
Oh my god,
belts.
Yeah.
The black belts are usually pretty nice to me, and yeah, I feel like I'm gonna say a couple names and they're gonna be like, we went super easy. Yeah. I went super easy on you, man.
No, it's true. Whenever we go visit a gym, especially together, like, I feel like I'll drop in someplace by myself and no one really recognizes me because it's just me. But when it's like Reed and I, and Reed's got the hair and stuff, you know, okay. I usually have some cameras with us, like all these little flow guys. And holy shit, the entire gym is like, I'm going to get a piece of the flow guys. And they're just coming after you.
They're like lining up.
That's the best training I'll ever get, because it's real. Like, some of it's real. Those purple belt juveniles just like, coming to kill you.
Yeah. I gotta say though, watching like you two roll, I didn't roll this day, but I remember watching you two guys. One guy who messed you both up pretty bad,
thanks, Hal,
and pretty mercilessly was Josh Hinger.
Oh yeah, Josh was pretty brutal too.
Because
that was back in the day. That was 2016.
It was back in the day. I mean, like,
I give him a better go this
time.
That
was a good session, because you both got to roll with Andre and you both got to roll with Josh, and Andre was like super playful and smiling the entire time and having a lot of fun, and like Josh was like, I don't know. He's like, how many times could he guillotine you both in one round?
I think it was like
he go-go plotted me. So,
ooh.
Yeah,
that was his Facebook banner for a while.
Foot in my face.
That was good. I sent him that photo.
Oh, great.
Oh my word!
But that was pretty nice. I'm trying to think. I think I'm like, I've puked a couple times at some gyms, and I think I was rolling with Carbolito one time, and I was like, I can't roll anymore. And then I was rolling at Unity a couple times, and I was like, I can't roll anymore. But
I've never puked from training. I've No, one time. I haven't. That was actually at Paragon, just at my home gym.
Wow.
It was just really hot. It's so hot here in Texas. We don't use AC. And
man, people have no idea how hot it gets here.
Yeah.
Really don't. I mean, like, what is it? It's like yesterday, for example, I saw people posting, you know, pictures of the thermometer in the car, and it was like 110, 115, 120 in some places. You know, it gets hot as shit here in Austin, Texas, right? But, I mean, even training in Brazil.
We don't tap where, pressure.
We don't tap
here in Austin.
But even training in Brazil, where it was like, hang on a second, I need to convert metric to.
If it's over 30, it's super hot.
I've trained in, the hottest I ever trained was the about 110 degrees Fahrenheit in Brazil in a room with no air conditioning.
Oh my God, I've never gotten that high.
It was Terra Ray's gym, actually. And it was like, had like kind of no windows. The windows were like this big. They were like a slit at the top of the room.
How did nobody die?
I mean, I wanted to. You know, I straight up wanted to. And that's actually the day that a 90 kilogram black belt decided that he was going to fly in triangle over my seated guard. And
that's a good feeling.
And I didn't roll for another 3 weeks after that. My neck was jacked. But anyway, but oh my God, it does get so hot here, right? Mm. It's like, because you guys just don't have AC in gyms. It's freaking
brutal. They're all, I don't know, gluttons for pain, I guess. All the coaches, they want to make you suffer.
I don't dislike it in some ways, though. I mean, I'll be honest, when the thermometer does get really, really hot, like some days I kind of second guess. I was, you know, consider like,
I've got those text messages. I know that.
The text messages saying like, basically, no, screw training today, it's way too hot.
No, I think it's worse. I hate going back to the East Coast
and then training in the cold
during the winter, right? Oh. You know, and it's just like freezing cold in there, and you have to take and you put your gi on, your gi's all stiff and everything, and it's like so cold, like, and then you have to get warm. Like, at least when it's 100 degrees, you're already sweating. So
for real, man. Actually, I love that, the fact that you basically sort of quick there we go, I'm warm, let's go.
Yeah,
you just
warm.
Train.
Yeah,
I'm not a morning training guy. I hate training than that. All the pros train like 9 a.m or earlier, and when I have to go to that, I just want to die. Like, yeah, I immediately, same. I tell people, like, if you are on a mission to, like, kill me, just find me before 9 a.m. in public, and I'll just tell you to end it right there, because I'm
like,
just not
when
ready.
When you're only halfway through first coffee of the day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'd rather be dead. So to fight for my life that early is just, like, a pointless exercise.
What would be your favorite time of the day? What would be the optimal time of the day to train?
Because I like a 12:30, 1 o'clock class. Like, enough to where I get, like, a snack in around 10 a.m., 11 a.m., let that process, and then go train, and then also have the whole evening to just do whatever I want. That's a perfect day.
I like the night training. I like a night training.
Night training?
Sure. Yeah. 6 p.m., 7 p.m. I like those for sure.
Yeah, I'm definitely not a morning guy either. I don't think any of us are, really, are we? But like those freaks who train at like 6 a.m. jiu-jitsu class. Like,
that would be a hard, hard thing to do.
I mean, I can't.
I don't know how Gary and Gordon, those guys, do that.
Right? I can't imagine walking onto the mat at, like, you know, basically while the sun is still rising and being asked to try and murder somebody. It's like, you know, I don't have that level of intensity in me at that morning, that time in the morning. But I always used to really, really enjoy training at like 4 in the afternoon. Like back in Brazil, we had a 4 o'clock in the afternoon class, and it was about perfect, because I would get up in the morning and I would work through till about 3:30, and then I would, like, you know, basically clock out, and I'd run to the gym, and I'd train from like 4 till 6 approximately. And it was just like the optimal time. It wasn't too late in the day when I was tired and out of energy, and it wasn't too early. It was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm like,
sounds pretty good.
It's a civilized hour.
Sounds good.
But, you know, the lifestyle in Brazil is a little bit different. Like here, a lot of people get out of work that early. I think if you went to a class, it'd be kind of empty, right? It's like either they duck out on their lunch hour, or kids class after school. It's like either they duck out on their lunch hour or they do it after work. It's like, I think the Brazilian lifestyle is a little bit like, nope. It's 3 o'clock. Time to go to the beach. Let's get out of here. You know, so
yeah. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I can get behind that for sure.
Now I'm trying to think of a really well known black belt who messed me up the most. And to be honest, the ones who have messed me up the most in training are just like random black belts that I've encountered in Brazil. Like, a lot of the time, these guys just have like zero name. And like, I remember when I first moved to Brazil, the first couple of years there, I was training at Gordo's gym. So Gordo had a gym, and every Saturday morning, they had the open mat. And I had never seen that many black belts in a room at one place. Like, up until that point, I'd walked in on the first Saturday morning open mat, and there were like 25 black belts chilling, and they were like maybe 8 colored belts. All the other color belts. It was just like a ton of black belts. And I discovered that a lot of these guys, a lot of them were old school Gracie Baja guys. So a lot of them trained Gracie Baja during the week. And then Saturday morning, because Gordo came from Gracie Baja, a lot of them would go train at his on Saturday morning. And it was just like rhymes. And it was just, man, like going in there as a gringo purple belt, you know, like they would look at you and they'd be like, fresh meat. there's my rest round right there, you know. There's my warm up, and I mean, some of them were just like I say, you know, older dudes, you know. Some of them, like, there was this one guy I remember. He had the craziest nickname. It was Carlos B3. Don't ask me why, but that was his nickname, Carlos B3.
That's a sweet nickname.
And apparently, he was a judge. Apparently, that was like his job. He was like a judge, and he was the meanest, nastiest black belt that I used to roll with in those sessions. And he was like probably a solid 210, like 5'9", just brick of a man, like no neck, and it just like would viciously paper cut to you from like side control. And you know that horrible pass when they kind of stack pass and put the hand in the collar and don't finish the pass, they just lift the hips over up and just choke you from there. You're like, your feet are kind of flopping around in midair and you're like tapping frantically. Yeah. He used to do that a lot. So, brutal. But the craziest thing was like that room of like I say, 25 kind of like black belts, all of them really, really solid. The day that Roger Gracie came in to train. Just, man, that was wild. And I actually had my camera with me because I was doing a little video with him that day. And he just walked in, and of course everybody knows who he is, right? A lot of those guys knew him from when he was a kid when he used to train at Gracie Baja. And he walks in and he just went through the room like they were white belts. Wasn't even close. Really wasn't. And like,
what year is this?
2011. So this is a while ago. But I mean, he'd still pretty much stopped, you know, competing in jiu-jitsu at that point. But holy crap, man. Just goes to show that there are levels to this thing. There are black belts, and there are black belts.
And then there are black belts, you know. No, that's one of the best things about jiu-jitsu, right? Is that like, to get there, to get to the end, you have to take your beatings, you know? You have to go through it. You have to know what it's like no matter what. There's somebody better than you always, every gym you go to. And so I think like going to different gyms, rolling with different people, rolling with higher belts, rolling with you know, elite competition and stuff like that, it only helps because it only lets you know how vast this sport is, lets you know how vast this knowledge of jiu-jitsu is. Because like, right, it's when you do, when I've been doing jiu-jitsu for 6 years, and when I roll with Marcelo Garcia and he makes me feel like I've never even heard of jiu-jitsu before, you know, it's incredibly humbling.
It's that phrase, isn't it? It just shows you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
It's really true, and you get constantly reminded of it, you know, day after day.
I like the fact that it's always evolving as well. So it's not like there is a finite point where you're like, I hit the bottom, or that's as good as it gets, because it's always something new, right? Mm-hmm. It's always something else coming along that's going to change things up.
Yeah, man. I feel like I've been really going after the lapel stuff. You know, Keenan's definitely changed my perspective on that. Before, I just knew the worm guard, like very basically what it was. But now it seems like everyone's been embracing lapel variations. I've seen a lot of cool stuff on Instagram of guys like doing weird inversions and just like, I don't know, it's endless, right? So I've been trying to see where the lapel takes me.
You know, speaking of that, I saw a video posted by the Dream Art Project the other day.
I love that one.
Those guys are hip with that too.
Right, and it was the Muniz brothers. So we've featured these guys a lot, Eric, Alex, and Anderson Muniz, who are now training in the Dream Art Project in Sao Paulo, the Alliance Talent Development System. And it was just like a short Instagram video of this, drilling this technique. And I mean, wow, it was like lapel guard armbar, man, it's just, it keeps going, right? It's just when you think that it's kind of hit a point, we're like, okay, yeah, I think that's kind of established now. It's like there's somebody comes along and adds something else. You found something cool the other day for the lapel stuff, right?
I don't know, I can't remember.
Yeah, the magazines.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, I thought you meant my own game. I'm like, no, I haven't discovered anything new.
Still struggling.
still having a hard time there. Yeah, so I was going through some old jiu-jitsu mags, and I saw Keenan on the cover. I scrolled through and found his techniques, and it was just called lapel guard stuff. Like, I mean, it was just lapel guard techniques. It wasn't any branded stuff like squid guard, but he was showing squid guard. There was an arm bar from there. I think he had a cool knee bar set up, but it was all the kind of modern stuff he's promoting now that he was.
This was like 2014.
So wow. He's been working at that for some time.
It looked like that same armbar that he hit on that Ignacio Neto that I have.
Oh, yeah,
that I have
that's
a,
right.
That I have a clip of.
Yeah, so
it looked like the same technique.
It wasn't invented yesterday, I guess. Keenan's been workshopping that for a long time before he puts that out.
I got to roll with Keenan.
Oh, you did?
None that's
of
it right.
Didn't
yeah,
work
yeah.
on me. None of the work didn't work.
You hear that? You hear that?
I gotta say, shout out to Keenan and Josh actually for the new podcast, Matt Byrne. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's awesome. Some definitely. Really funny stuff on there.
Yeah, yeah, I've been enjoying listening to that. So it's nice actually that you know there are actually quite a lot of jiu-jitsu podcasts out there, right? We've been doing some research this past week or so, me and Chase, because Chase has a new show coming out
Chasing Greatness, a little pun there, if you will. But it wasn't always called that. It was going to be called Free Roll.
And until we found out somebody, else,
found out somebody else had that, so we had to change it up a little bit. But I'm super excited to start this new series. It's kind of branching out from a few Skype interviews that I had done over the past few months. And they did well, so we want to make it a little more formal, a little more official. So I'm doing a weekly series called Chasing Greatness, where it's
who's your first guest?
First guest is 2018 world champion Muhammad Ali, and it's just an overview of his life, his experiences in the sport, where he came from, all kinds of stuff, and it's not just competition focused, you know, it's just what jiu-jitsu means to him, you know. I think one of the more interesting segments is how his life changed and didn't change after winning a world title. You know, he had all these assumptions like, I win the world title, I make money. Nope, no one hands him anything, you know. So he's got to create this hustle, and so we talk a lot about his YouTube series called Sotinho. I think I'm saying that right or close. And it's a weekly interview that he does with just various legends and athletes and so on in the sport. Really cool stuff.
Very popular.
Very popular. I wish I spoke Portuguese, but he did tell me he's going to launch more English content.
Good.
But either way, it's super cool, and I love getting to meet these guys and chat with them about. You know, what we all love so much. You know, that's his entire life, and it really is my entire life now, too. So to have these vastly different experiences and yet love it the same is really cool to connect with. So I invite you guys to check out that show and give me some feedback. Let me know you want to hear more of, who you'd like to see. So
suggestions for guests would be really cool.
Yeah, it'd be really cool. Right? I'd love to open it up. You know, there's no rules. You know, it's supposed to be open-ended, free-form, just a what are we talking about today in jiu-jitsu? So yeah, it's good stuff.
I like it. And speaking of new releases, Reed, you've got a really cool project which is about to drop that you've been working on for months and months, I feel like. Tell us about it. What is it?
Yeah, we got some exciting content coming up here on jiu-jitsu. Got a lot of all of us working on some really cool stuff, so definitely keep an eye out. We're ramping things up and bringing more and more cool content, but this is one that I'm especially excited about. This is a kind of a new series that we're launching on Flow Grappling called The New Guard. And you know, the jiu-jitsu landscape is changing, especially right now. You know, right now there's so many new black belts, and there's so many you know, new stars in the sport emerging all over the place, you know. And so The New Guard is going to be a new documentary series where we kind of profile and follow along the next generation of stars, the future of jiu-jitsu. And
this is not limited to black belts either, right?
No, we're definitely identifying guys and girls who are, you know, who I think have a strong chance and who have been in the sport for many years already, have had some big wins and things like that. But yeah, definitely at purple belt, at brown belt, in even black belt, you know, we know how hard, you know, how high level these purple belts now are, these brown belts are now. And so right out the gate, we're leading with a guy that, you know, we know very well here. I've been following him for the last 3-4 years, Roberto Jimenez, purple belt world champion. And I'm really, really excited to tell his story. He's got such an exciting story.
Well, especially that moment that he won the purple belt world championship as well, right? That stands out because it was freaking epic. You couldn't have written a better story, right?
Man, for me, what's so cool about it, watching it, is all the archival footage and stuff. I mean, we've been following this guy for years, but we've been filming him for years. Yep. And Reed collected all his footage from 2016 on, and it's just so cool to see Roberto kind of grow up in front of the camera, you know, in its own way. So I think it's probably my favorite flow film documentary style piece we've done.
But just tell us really quick though about that Purple Belt World Championship right there, about what the actual, because I don't, maybe people don't realize, because 2018 World Championships, a lot happened, right? And maybe, you know,
feels so long ago even now.
But. It does, and maybe got overshadowed a little bit because hey, it was just the Purple Belt, and, you know, the brown belt, black belts as well. So what actually happened with Roberto?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of the most impressive things that happened at the World Championships there that day. You know, going into that tournament, Roberto wasn't really as highly touted. You know, we thought maybe he was going to need a couple years to get acclimated to adult, but he came in and he put on a show, and he had 10 fights between weight and absolute, and he submitted all 10 of his fights. He won double gold at, it was his first major title at adult. He never won Europeans, he never won Pans, never won Nogi Worlds, and he comes out at Worlds his first year at the in the adult divisions, submits all 10 of his opponents, including guys like Mason Fowler and Connor DeAngelis. It was a stacked run, and just one of the best stories really of the day to see how he was able to overcome a lot of these setbacks that he had earlier in his adult career, and how he righted those moments and was able to come out of it, you know, the other side, and just a great story. Roberto, a really great guy, and it's a lot of fun. We just put up a little animation in there. We got a lot of different elements, archive footage, interview footage, the animation, you know, some old matches of Roberto when he's like 6 years old. You know, this is some cool stuff that I think you guys are gonna really dig. We got a couple more in the can that we're working on. This is going to be a thing that we're going to do regularly.
So New Gods are going to be a series?
Yeah, we're going to do a nice series and really make sure that everybody out there is hip to the next generation, to these guys who are making waves in the lower belts, you know, their first year at black belt, these guys who are innovating the sport forward and everything like that. I think there's so much talent out there, and we got to, you know, highlight as much as we can of it.
Awesome. So speaking of talent, actually, I mean, like, you know, without kind of revealing anybody who's going to be your future featured stars on this documentary series, but just very quickly, like, you know, just go around the table, like, New Guard. When you say the words New Guard and you think about those up and comers in any belt color, who kind of stands out for you? Start with Chase. What do you think?
Man, I mean, I think it's hard to deny Will Tackett at this point. I mean, he's been all over our site for the last like 2 months, basically. Every day there's a new story about him, but he's winning a lot of stuff, and he's, you know, a teenager, he's a purple belt still, and also, of course, you know, a young American star. So definitely always interested in seeing people come from places that are not supposed to have major breakout stars. He's not from San Diego, he's not from New York, he's here from Austin, Texas. So
yeah. You know, I got some interesting, you know, tidbits about William Tackett, actually, is that he was actually at Kasai last week because he was competing 2 days later on the Jits King,
sure,
which was in Tampa. So he flew into Orlando and he was there for the Kasai on Thursday night. Excuse me. And then Saturday he competed at the Jits King 16-man, 165-pound Nogi tournament, which was purple, brown, and black belts together. Mm. Incredible. He won, right? And he did really, really well. He had, like, I think 3 submissions in 4 matches, including a very fast, like, 1 minute, 10 second submission of Enrico Coco. That's a big deal because Enrico's, like, you know, an ADCC veteran, Nogi specialist, right? Mm. So pretty noteworthy. But it's interesting because there's a lot of buzz around William, and not just from us. People are noticing. The guys from Kasai, they noticed, and they hit me up, and they were like, what do you think about us putting William on the show? And I'm like, I think that's not a bad idea, you know? I think he could do pretty well. On his, I think it was on his podcast, you know, the Keenan's mentioned about how he wants to bring together, you know, various guys, Americans, to make up part of his new team, right?
Interesting.
And he straight up said that guys like William Tackett and Cody Steele and those guys, you know, he would love to have them. So if people like Keenan and the promoters of Kasai know your name and you're a purple belt, that's pretty freaking good, right?
Yeah, and I know Seth was real hip to the Tackett brothers. There's 2 of them.
They've both really early. Twin, right?
I remember. I think the first San Antonio show we went to, I don't even remember what year that was, he was talking these guys up. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, definitely people are clued in. But now the general mainstream audience is starting to get a taste, I think.
That's really cool. For me, I am one up and comer, a new guard guy that that really impressed me this year, both at Pans and Worlds, and I'm excited to see, you know, develop. I think he just got promoted to brown belt not too long ago. Was Mayrum Alves?
Oh yeah, definitely.
So he's a young guy. I think he's light feather or feather.
Light feather,
and he's out. No,
I think he might be feather because he's kind of small. That always stands out to me. Like, he's small for the division. I mean,
okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, he's a lightweight guy. And he's competing out of Gigo Jiu-Jitsu in Sao Paulo in Brazil, but also reps TLI because he, you know, the interchange, the they kind of have like this exchange program going on with Gigo and TLI, right? Lloyd Irvin was explaining it to me a while ago that it turns out that Lloyd and Gigo, they both got their black belts from kind of the same source. So that's why there's a relationship between the two teams and why a lot of Gigo guys, when they go to the States, they go to, you know, do their world training camp, for example, at Lloyd's. And that's why they kind of rep like both teams and stuff when they compete. But Mayrum, I mean, wow, Pans especially, he just tore through everybody. He was like flying submissions. He had like four matches in the space of about combined like 3 minutes or something, and, you know, put the guy to sleep in the final. It was just freaking epic. So he's a guy who stands out. I'm keeping a close eye on him. Nice kid as well.
Yeah, he's a ton of fun to watch. He looked great at Worlds too until the final match where he ended up getting second place, I believe. Last minute advantage or last minute 2 points. I don't
remember.
Big
shock. Yeah,
it was that new rule there where it was like he came up and then he went back down.
He came up for a takedown and sat down.
A few people got caught out. Yeah. You got caught out with that, right? At Pans, I remember. Because remember, on that sweep from the half guard, and then you decided to sit back down, and the other guy got two. And I was freaking out because I was in the corner. I was like, what? Like, no, wait. A lot of people, I think, they maybe that rule passed them by. So, anyway, who else you got, Reed? Like, maybe you don't want to spoil the documentary.
Yeah, maybe not. But I guess I'll give a shout out to Fionn, just because I think that Fionn's a great candidate. Fionn Davies there from East Coast Jiu-Jitsu. Now she trains out in Ireland, and she's just she's had a great run at black belt since she's graduated black belt. So I think that she is somebody that definitely embodies that kind of new generation, I think.
I'd love to hear more about her judo background, right? Because she's a high-level judo player earlier, and I don't know anything else, really. But, you know, when she came to the fray, so...
Yeah, I agree, actually. I'd really like to know more about, you know, how she comes from... Actually, we come from the same country. We come from Wales, right? Part of the UK. And it's small, man. It's like 3 million people, you know, in the entire country. It's not exactly known as a hotbed of jiu-jitsu talent. But we actually have, like, a lot of jiu-jitsu there now. Like, a lot of homegrown black belts. But she is by far, you know, the highest profile and the one to have really gone, you know, broke onto the scene and done something special. And I'd kind of like to know how she managed that. Mm-hmm. Because it's not easy getting onto the highest level, of, you know, the world stage. But certainly not coming from a place like that, you know? It's like, again, like you said, not coming from San Diego or New York or Brazil or whatever it is. So it's nice when you see some people kind of, you know, it's like the Norwegians. It's like the Vikings, right?
Yeah, those guys definitely.
Yeah, you know, this is a great example, you know? I don't even know how many the population of Norway, but it's pretty small, right? And they're way out there. They're not even like the metropolitan center.
There's like 127 people, I want to say.
Yeah, 128.
Norway.
I think we counted last time we were there.
You met them all. Yeah. Awesome. Well, guys, it's probably a good time to wrap it up. That
back
was a good episode today.
Back to Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yeah, absolutely.
Always. Let's throw it on.
Cool. Well, guys, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us once again. Another episode of Fistful of Collars. I think we'll probably do this again next week or thereabouts. Actually, yes, we are doing it next week because we have a very special guest coming into the studio next week. None other than 3-time world champion, Claudia Duval.
Going to be awesome.
It is. We always like having guests in the studio and getting a multiple-time world champion like that. Yeah, fantastic. So look forward to that. We'll be shooting a bunch of stuff with her in the studio and just in town over that couple of days. We'll probably get to fix my game out of that chase, right?
I hope so. Absolutely. Yeah. I'd love to get another one of those shots. So
get some techniques, get some other stuff. So it'll be a lot of fun. Looking forward to that. Cool. Well, you guys, see you next time.